Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 71 of the Alexis Cell podcast. And slight switch of format today. I'm going for a kind of zoo. I've got my posse together today. I'm going for like a zoo thing. This is going to be like Steve Wright in the afternoon from about 2009. And got my gang. I got Talal and I got Sammy Abu. Why they make some noise, guys? Make go whoop.
Woo.
All enthusiasm, do some clapping as well. Woo. Yeah, we're gonna be doing the recipe later and crazy things that tortoises do we've got, and then I'll be doing some of my comic characters.
And I'm, of course, bringing my biggest arse competition back after 3 years away. Send in those arse picks, gang. We're going to measure them. Biggest arse award.
Yeah, biggest arse.
Winner gets a signed poster of me.
No, they were just, we're trying to keep it more conversational than them. So, Sammy, tell us about yourself. Welcome to the early morning, afternoon, evening crew.
I know, right?
KCZMJJJKF.
What does that stand for?
It stands for nothing at all.
Okay. I'm Sammy. I'm a comedian and an actor, and I write as well. I've been doing comedy for about 8 or 9 years now, professionally, and I had a really good sort of debut hour in 2022, and I made a Channel 4 digital series that same year as well. And yeah, I was working on my second hour in 2023, and then everything started happening in Palestine.
Oh, yes.
And so I sort of initially had to adjust to that with my comedy, and then eventually I took a little break, and now I'm putting on an hour show now. I've sort of
yes, those people in Gaza, they should think of the comedians sometimes, shouldn't they? How we've suffered really. Yeah. Trying to adapt. It's been tremendously difficult for me writing my new series of sandwich bar, just because people have been genocided.
Shawarma bar.
No, it's proper old-fashioned sandwich bar. So what can you, I mean, just what are your, what's your ethnicity, as it were?
Yeah, so my dad's Palestinian. My father was born in a town called Limwele, which is inside the 1948 border. It was ethnically cleansed in 1948. He was born in 1941. So when he was a little boy, his town was ethnically cleansed, and they were moved across the armistice line. Eventually, and my extended family are in Balata refugee camp in Nablus, and also some outside of Balata refugee camp.
In the West Bank.
Nablus, which is in the West Bank. Mm-hmm. And my mother, so my grandparents were Irish immigrants to Liverpool. My mother was born in Liverpool. She sends her regards. She's very excited that I'm on this podcast.
We all know each other, of course.
Yeah.
Does she know Iggy Jimmy? That was his Scousey McStab face. You must know him.
Do you want me to give her a ring?
No, sorry.
Okay. I can ask her.
Yeah, we all do know each other.
Yeah.
Know.
Yeah.
I always forget you're half Irish as well. That's the...
Scouse Irish, you know, that's an interesting part of my identity, because we wouldn't really call ourselves English, you know, because it's a bit complicated in that way. I'm sure you might understand that, Alexi. So I suppose ethnically we call ourselves Irish in that sense. I was born in Kuwait. We were displaced, I guess you could say, because we had a life there. You know, my parents were there for a good 25 years.
A lot of the people who did the sort of both administrative work and I guess physical work were in Kuwait, were Palestinians.
Exactly. It was the center of the Palestinian diaspora in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, I would say. I mean, right up until the invasion by Saddam Hussein. And we were there my parents had me when they were a little older, so they were there for a good 25 years odd, and then I was born, and then when I was a little boy, we had to, you know, leave everything behind. We ended up back in London. Then I moved around a lot, and then ended up sort of finishing off my schooling in Dubai, and came to the UK. Yeah,
and decided to be a comedian. So, well, just to jump ahead a bit, I'm not particularly connected, I think, with the, you know, with the comedy scene, really. But my sense is that a lot of comedians, certainly the bigger names, that have been by and large silent over this genocide. How is it on the circuit? I don't know, whichever part of the
it's been very strange. I mean, it's been a very odd. However, God knows how many months it's been now. Last count, it was 14 or 15. 15. Yeah. It was an odd experience. When it started, there was this sort of, like, you know, somebody slammed the brakes on, and you're moving forward in a car, and you're all moving forward, and then it just felt like, whoa, you know, guys, we need to talk about this. You know, from my end, it was like, what's happening? And then the vast majority of comedians just carried on as normal. Now, I'm just saying that I'm saying that in a descriptive way. I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm really genuinely not judging them, to be honest. Like, I think that's a very complicated conversation. How a comedian, specifically, especially a stand-up on the circuit, should respond to something like this, and that's a complicated conversation. But whatever the rightness or wrongness of it, it is what happened. You know, the vast majority of comedians carried on doing their stuff. You know, and so we'd be in the middle of this, you know, genocide a few months in, and you have comedians talking about, you know, the routine stand-up comedy material, ex-girlfriends and ex-boyfriends and ordering pizza and things like that.
Yeah.
And as an act and an audience member, it felt quite jarring. That felt very, very jarring.
And did you get a sense that audiences also were aware of that dislocation? Or
no. No, right. Audiences didn't. Mainstream. I have to say, my experience of mainstream audiences, because I was one of the, in my experience, few comedians who had shifted their entire material in order to talk about Palestine, and most mainstream audiences either didn't want to hear it, or didn't want to hear it in the way that I was presenting it.
Really?
And that, in a way, that was more distressing for me than sort of the comedian's not talking about it. The comedian's not talking about it. I was like, you know what, you know, you do you, that's fine. But it was the audiences who would react negatively towards certain things, which would be like, really? You think Benjamin Netanyahu is not a war criminal? Like, you have a problem with me making a joke about that? And it was really surprising, the number of people in mainstream audiences. When I say mainstream audiences, I mean your regular punters. They want to go out for a night of comedy. They see something advertised and they turn up.
Yeah, give me an example of where this would be.
Oh, really? Anywhere? Like, honestly, any sort of central London club, you know, any sort of central London club that has a lineup of your sort of a typical stand-up lineup, I'd say. And it was a few different places. And again, like, no fault of the club at all. It was just a phenomenon that sort of, it was the general public, the shared ideology of the general public, sort of abutting against the politics of you know what is decent, I think.
Right.
It was a very strange experience, having to sort of go through that. It was very, and at the same time, I mean, you were joking when you said that, you know, the residents should think of the poor comedians in the UK, but that was like, at the same time, it's like you were hitting on a truth there, where it's like, I can't really complain. You know, I was like, this is very difficult to be doing this, but there's a genocide going on. Like, I'm not going to speak publicly about, you know, the challenge of making comedy in this time, because that's irrelevant at this moment.
Yeah.
And it was, and to some extent, it's not, I wouldn't say it's irrelevant. Nothing's necessarily irrelevant, but there is a pecking order of issues, I think. And this issue is further down the list than certain other ones, I think, when it comes to what's actually happening in.
Have you noticed any of the other mainstream comics, the famous ones taking a stand. I know Nish Kumar, for instance, was
Nish,
that.
Nish has been very good. I mean, I gigged with him. I did a Stand Up for Palestine, not Stand Up for Palestine, it was Stand Up for MAP, for Medical Aid for Palestinians at the Comedy Store. He was on that lineup. He was very good. Rob Delaney, wow, he's really come through. Like, incredible really? Guy. Wow. Yeah, really, really, like, so heartwarming to see what, you know, and to chat to him backstage and, like, you know, it's like, wow, you're, you know. they're speaking up, they're doing their bit, I suppose. Otherwise, it's been, off the top of my head, you know, I need to fact check this, but the top of my head, I can't really think of anyone really. I mean, Frankie Boyle has always been pro-Palestine. I think he's sort of, I know that he's on side, you know, and I don't, I don't know, for some reason, I don't really begrudge him for not like putting it front and center, but.
Mm. He does it on his social media.
I'm sure. He does.
It's weird that he took that turn against Corbyn when he had that TV show.
He says in retrospect he was sort of intimidated into it, really. But.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
He just had a go at the Corbyn bashing. He grabbed the bat for a few swings.
He did, yes. It was a bit sad. That was disappointing, yes.
And obviously,
indeed.
Sammy is why we got Paul Curry on the show. He's who got in touch with Paul Curry. And you and Paul talked a lot over that. Did you have any experience from venues in that kind of ilk where venues kind of betrayed you or anything?
Betrayed me? No. There were. The Paul Curry incidents happened so early on in the genocide that it was a bit of a, how do I say? It was like I watched and I learned how to keep myself safe. I was like, okay, this is the playing field we're on. This is what these people are doing. So I've been very careful ever since that incident, and the, Soho Theatre releasing a statement that resulted in Paul Curry losing a lot of work. And in my opinion, implying that he holds anti-Semitic views when I don't believe he does. Ever since that incident, I've been taking extra security steps. So they include filming every single set that I do every time and getting evidence on camera.
That's why you do that.
Yeah. I film every single set that I do. When I engage with the audience, there have been moments where, you know, I've engaged with an audience member or audience members who are very, very clearly not on side. and it's about, you know, it's about staying calm, asking questions, you know, and being comfortable not being funny for a few moments. Mm. That whole thing really sort of was a bit of an education in how to then navigate that world of performing comedy about Palestine,
right,
within the UK.
Yeah,
and I'm very happy if any comedians want tips or want to talk through stuff. I'm always happy to talk to them about it.
Sounds like it might be worth it. Yeah,
yeah, because it's a new world now, and it can be scary. But I think if we're well equipped, we can do something.
Yeah, yeah. What happened with Reg? I mean, Reg D. Hunter just kind of kept his head down, didn't he?
I think, I didn't really follow that. All I know is he had some apparent, they appeared from the story to be disruptors in the audience. And so what's interesting is I've noticed since the start of all this sort of, since the genocide started and the sort of turning up the propaganda to 11 through every channel available that the powers that be have, I've noticed a difference in how people who are new to Palestine or relatively new to Palestine or don't necessarily have lived experience or intergenerational experience of Palestine, how those people engage with it and how people who are a bit more seasoned with it engage with it. And it's like, I think for a lot of Palestinians, we know, especially Palestinians in the West, we know what we know how to play the game a little bit. You know, yeah. what I mean, we know how to navigate the world of language and meaning such that we can protect ourselves if we need to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Whereas absolutely. I think for a lot of people who are coming to it afresh, I think right. they're not familiar with the extent to which collective ideology and language and its meaning has been manipulated yeah. by, I mean, historical forces. You know, it's not limited to Zionism or Zionists. It is much bigger than that, in my opinion.
Yeah, but I think you make an interesting point there that while it is wildly unfair and the censorship or the attempted censorship of pro-Palestinian voices and the actual censorship of pro-Palestinian voices and both in the news and in the entertainment business, there's no point in bitching about it, really, is there? There's no point in just, I mean, you can't say that it is unfair and that's reasonable, but also you have to, as you say, find a way around it, really.
Yeah, it's sort of this, you know, it's this dance where it's like, well, you know, this is the game. The rules are sort of set in the West, right?
And yeah.
And we know what they are. And depending on which space you occupy and which circles you move in, there are ways you can express yourself that will potentially be more effective. And there are ways that in other spaces you can express yourself that may be both effective and more true. Does that kind of make sense?
Well, I don't know. Expand on that.
Like, I don't know. Like, I suppose if I'm having a conversation with, okay, So, for example, if I were to do a set, the reason I brought up mainstream audiences before was because a lot of the gigs I've done in the last year and a bit have been Palestine solidarity gigs,
right?
And they are a completely different crowd.
Yeah,
and you know, it's not so much that I adjust my language, but there are certain things that, you know, I will say differently or you know, certain jokes I'd make a bit differently because the Palestinian solidarity crowd will cheer and enjoy certain jokes at the expense of genocidal politicians, for example. Whereas mainstream audiences feel very uncomfortable with that. And so what I'm illustrating there is a situation where as a Palestinian or a person who is sympathetic to the Palestinian cause, going into the space of the mainstream audience, I have a question to ask myself is, to what extent do I want to keep these people comfortable? And to what extent am I going to sort of push the envelope and sort of knowingly make them, you know, because I know that a proportion of the crowd will feel uncomfortable when I make a joke at the expense of Benjamin Netanyahu.
Right.
And it's a question that's sort of the question that we must ask ourselves when we go into those spaces and then make a choice and then follow through with that choice ideally. And there is no right or wrong answer in that situation. Like if a comedian wants to adjust their set for a mainstream crowd in order to do something they might feel is more effective, then so be it, you know? I remember watching Mo Amer for the first time, doing stand-up when I first heard of him a few years back. And when I was making my show, my first hour, it was centered around my Palestinian identity, but that was sort of incidental. It was more about having multiple different identities, having grown up in lots of different parts of the world and having right. more than one heritage. And I was researching Palestinian comics. I was like, how do Palestinian comedians talk about being Palestinian? This is in 2019, yeah? I was like, how do they do it? Because it's so complicated. It's so, especially diaspora Palestinian experience and identity. Because in comedy, as you well know, you want to get up on stage and you want to sort of, it's quite very useful to be boxed in, to be typecast, to say, I'm the posh English guy, I'm the working class, you know, so-and-so, and then you can make jokes around it. And I found it impossible to write that for being Palestinian that did not co-opt sort of prejudiced ideology.
Yeah.
So like jokes where it's like, oh, a terrorist, or, you know, jokes about losing land, or it's like, well, being Palestinian is so much more than that. I kind of don't want to lower myself to that. And so I was looking at them, and then Mohammed, I saw Mohammed and I saw his big set. I think he was on Conan or something. He didn't talk about being Palestinian back then, as far as I remember. That's something I remembered. I was like, you're not centering being Palestinian. He talked about being mistaken for being Mexican. He talked about a lot of things. Again, this is, I'm not judging him whatsoever, just an observation. And so it's like he went into that space knowing it's like these people, their ideas about Palestine are so, the average American sort of audience member at Conan or whichever show he did, their ideas about Palestine are so manipulated by propaganda that he's like, I have to sort of work with that. You know, I have to ease myself in a little bit. So that's what I mean to your question of give me an example of what that means.
And he has now, I mean, with the TV show, he has, it's much more about being Palestinian, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, yes, the TV show is a way of expanding the dialogue and hopefully enhancing the general public's opinions, because that kind of humor you're talking about, Sammy, where you're relying on the typecast that you are, that is so reliant on stereotypes, on what the public sphere's general opinion is of a certain class, breed, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so if you're going to play to that, you're going to have to do the terrorist joke, the fucking falafel, fucking whatever. So by adding more to the conversation, like he's done with his TV show, hopefully the stereotypes slowly will change over time. So that's, I'm really glad that that show exists, even though I've only just started watching it. I'm glad that these things are being injected into the conversation. Like
absolutely. That. Yeah. It is so important that it's out there. And I think I really encourage new comics, especially new, you know, just because we share an identity, new Arab comics or comics who consider themselves Arab or have Arab heritage. I would like to encourage my colleagues to really expand their sort of ideas of how we can joke about our identity that do not involve co-opting the Western narrative, I think. And it's a very, very hard job, because you need, as a comic, it's your job to get in there and get the laugh quickly, right?
Yeah.
And I've forgotten
that that we are in the business of laughter.
Very much so. Yeah. Yeah.
When I was just starting out, I remember once just playing up, I did when I was only just starting, I remember doing like, oh, I'm bombing tonight or something like that kind of gag, and then feeling horrible about it. And then realizing I was too young and inexperienced to really tackle the heavy stuff. So I from very early on, I had a tack where I would make it very clear to the audience that I'm an Arab, but then I would avoid doing anything too heavy politically and trying to be very smart and intellectual on stage. I would just be a silly, goofy clown. And that my intention was just adding that to the, like, just existing and being a silly fucker.
Yeah.
While the audience are no fully aware that I'm an Arab, and yet he's being a goofy douchebag and swearing and being silly and, you know, making dick jokes and bum jokes and making them laugh, most importantly.
Most importantly.
That was like, for me, I'm like, that is a political statement in itself. It's just existing and being likable and silly. And Arab, I'm like, the minimum I could do is that. I don't have to sit there and preach and lecture them about, until I'm more experienced and wise. So, you know, this is something I'm still struggling with, and I'm trying to work on something, but I haven't found it yet. I don't know. But when I saw you last year, Sammy, if I can just, I haven't known you since the beginning of your comedy career, but when I first saw you performing, I think Alexi was there with me, actually. It was at the Freedom Theater fundraiser. When I first saw you, you were very focused on doing character stuff, kind of clowny stuff, but you would have all these different guises you'd walk on as you were saying, focusing on the multicultural aspect of your life and with a political thread through it. But it was very silly, very fun, really hilarious. And then the next time I saw you after, once the current war began, you'd completely changed. And you had only a couple of character bits in there. And then the rest of it was like you were working out some new tirades, Netanyahu jokes, ranting. Yeah. And it was furious and angry. And I think you were really struggling to reach that point. And then you finally just dove in and started bashing it out. What was that like for you, deciding, like, I'm going to go up there and talk and try and teach these motherfuckers something, or is that what you were even thinking?
No, it wasn't. I would never walk on to a comedy stage with the intention of teaching an audience anything. I think that's once that's your intention, that way comedy does not lie.
Yeah.
So no. And the first 6 years of my comedy, I was doing silly characters, as you say. I was doing comedy. I would call it character clowning. So it was sort of like in character, very committed. And, you know, I was a flamenco guitarist who couldn't, you know, nobody could understand what he's saying, but he's speaking English. And he would sing a lot. He would sing a song to make people fall in love and those sorts of things. And so the hard gear change, which you're referring to, was a challenge, because I realized, well, I have to find a way to talk about this on stage. And I had two realizations. I was like, my wheelhouse, which was character clowning, I couldn't see a way for that to be used effectively to talk about this stuff on stage. And so I made the decision quite quickly to just go fully into stand-up, which is not something that I had ever done before, but I had, having done comedy for several years in a different form, I had a lot of skills that were applicable to stand up. So I made that decision to go, well, I think the only format that's going to work for this is going to be stand up. So I just started writing jokes. I just started writing one liners, just every day. On the way to every gig I went to, I tried to slip in a new one liner. And that was, you know, that was an interesting experience, because the premise for all of my one-liners was Palestine should be free. Benjamin Netanyahu is a war criminal, you know, like, I was listening to a lot of Frankie Boyle at the time as well, because he's, you know, he does that very well. And the anger, so there was, I think by the time we did that work in progress together, Dalal, I think it was about half, there were a lot of one-liners, and there were also longer bits that were not one-liners, a bit of stories, a bit of stuff. That was me trying to work out how to then, in addition to the one-liners, start to do longer sets where it was like telling a story about, you know, getting into the wrong Uber and, you know, all fundamentally in an ideal world, I hope, still comedy, but with the core of the comedy is sort of going, you know, just like me getting into the wrong Uber and leaving because I'm in the wrong place, you know, and so illegal settlers are in the wrong place getting into Palestine, you know, like that was the punchline of that bit, you know. And so, you know, there are ways, as I was telling you before, there are ways to talk about identity and politics that you know, that can work, right? And
have you found that balance yet? Do you think you've found it?
I took a break. I've been. I have to say, I burnt out a few months ago. I had to take a little break because I felt after however many months it was, 10 months of this genocide and gigging, I felt like I had taken upon myself. Basically, I was like, right, how can I help with my skills, with the spaces that I occupy? How can I help the cause, whatever? I mean, that's a very, that's a very loaded term, the cause. And we can talk about that, but you know, I think you know what I mean by that. Like, how can I help the cause to liberate the Palestinian people? And you know, I made a decision. I was like, well, I'm one of the only very few Palestinian comedians in the country, you know, working, gigging on the circuit. I'm possibly the most experienced one in the country, and in addition to Joanna Carolan, who I must mention, she's very, very good.
We should get her on, Alexei.
She's great.
Go on, carry on. Sure.
Just
completely. Then you let you. This would be reverse occupation. You let me spell, out.
Yeah. How do you spell Carolan?
Go on. It's already. It's 2-1. Arab.
Yeah. Right. and so yeah, I kind of. I took it upon myself. I was like, well, I think the best way I can help is to just take up space in these spaces. I very intentionally continued to gig and made the decision to start talking about Palestine in those gigs because nobody else was. And I was like, you know, I have, you know, this is, I don't have to, but this is what I believe is my duty now, is because no one, no other Palestinian comedians are, or no other comedians are going to do that. And I am one of the only Palestinian comedians. So I must go, go and do that. And it's like, it would just kept on going and going and going. And then I was doing the material and the genocide just continued and it wouldn't stop and it wouldn't stop. And I just felt, after a few months of that, I just felt like I was screaming into the abyss.
Mm.
And I was putting myself at risk because we've all seen what happened to Reginald D. Hunter, Paul Curry, amongst others. Like, you know, there is a real tangible risk. You know, there are disruptors and they have a lot, they're very well resourced. And so after a while, I just need to take a break. And now I'm coming back into it. I'm headlining a gig in a couple of months. I'm doing some more map gigs and my show has become an hour of a comedy theater show. So that's being put on in May as well. So, yeah.
Where will that be?
That'll be at Teatro Technis as part of Shubak Festival.
I know. Yeah. I mean, is that your aim now, to do a new hour and
take it up to the
dreaded Edinburgh? And
it's
all that
happening. Edinburgh. I mean, Edinburgh Fringe. That's an interesting conversation to have, really, isn't it? Because I made the conscious decision to sort of decenter it from my career and my work and my schedule. Because of how, I mean, I'm sure you know the reasons why. It's prohibitively expensive. It's quite difficult to get into. So it's not that I wouldn't do it. And I have, I apply to do it. But you know, it's not the end of the world if
it's
I don't
not
do
what
it.
It's just another
festival, really. Yeah, it's just another festival. Yeah. You know, people go there to get the attention of TV people. You know, I kind of got that with my last show and, I don't feel like, you know, it's not, like I said, I've decentered it. It's not the be all and end all anymore.
I'd go. Leicester's the new Edinburgh now.
Is it?
Yeah.
All right, Leicester.
It's more fringy. It's what an actual fringe should be, but it's big enough to make you some money, hopefully.
Yeah. Edinburgh's just been like a trade show, hasn't it, for years, right?
Yeah. So to sort of speak to what you were saying, Talal, I took a break and now I'm coming back to it in a much more, I feel a lot better now. I'm coming back to it in a much more sort of, you know, wholesome, I guess, way is one way of putting it, where I'm kind of much more aware of what I'm trying to achieve within the work itself.
It's kind of like the story of the fucking, I don't know, like the revenge kung fu film, that the guy's like been through the gauntlet, got beaten up really to the end of his tether, goes home, licks his wounds, recovers for 4 months in a den, does 200 push-ups a day, and then comes back. And now he's so much more zen and in control.
Yeah.
Walks into any room, looks at all the enemies, knows exactly where to punch them all. That's you right now. The Arab version of that.
The
Arab theatre clown comic version of the kung fu.
That's an interesting point as well about, I mean, I think that, well, yeah, I mean, the idea, I mean, it, I suppose people can't necessarily do it, but I think to step back from your work, if you can, I think the worst thing is probably to keep on grinding for years in the same old way without reflecting on what you do. And that's not a, you know, there is a certain attraction to working all the time, because it can make you sharper, but you know, there's also something to be said for stepping back, really.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I feel like I have so much more clarity now that I stepped back for a few months, and so much more clarity in what I can do and how I want to do it and how I want to say it as well.
I remember terrifying Lenny Henry years ago, because Lenny just worked all, I mean, less so now, but he was, you know, he'd be doing fucking RAF bases at lunchtime. And I just said to him, you know, the less I do, the better I get, Len. And he was just like, just threw him into a terrible panic, really. And I was like, I was just trying to fucking with his brain. But, you know, I mean, I think there is some truth to that. Probably
no, absolutely. When you're even like at a skill or a hobby, you I find that having a break from things, sometimes you come back with a brand new, a bit like I'm a amateur drummer. And if I haven't drummed in a long time and I sit in front of a kit again, something in my brain has like reorganized itself and I'm just thinking about it in a new way.
Yeah.
And I do something that impresses me and I'm like, oh, that's new. And oh, where did I get that from? Whereas if you're just constantly doing it, you find yourself in one train of thought.
Yeah.
You're just going down the same track. And yeah, it's
like they say, skill. It's like breathing. They say, you know, like you're creating is like breathing out, you know, and you have to, yeah, take some time off for it. Yeah.
just stop breathing for a week or two.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, breathing in and breathing out. You know, you want to create, it's giving life to something and breath. Mm. And then you can't breathe out constantly. You have to take a break and take a breath.
Yeah. You know? I mean, my own experience has been, yes, that I would be, now that Sandwich Bar is done and dusted and going out on the 5th of March, everybody, write to your MP. Email the BBC about it. That I feel it just struggling with what you do in that situation is just has been a challenge that nobody would dreamt that we would ever face, really.
Yeah.
And yeah, approach. And my approach has probably been different to yours. I remember telling Rich that, the producer, that, you know, this is going to be, you know, I'm not going to back off from saying, you know, this is going to be all about genocide and, you know, it's going to be really. And I found in the end that really that wasn't my. That approach didn't work for me as an artist, really.
Yeah.
That I couldn't, you know, you can't, our job is to be entertainers, like you said, and get laughs and not to be agitators. And so, it is a show which I think, in a way, even when it's not talking about the genocide, it's talking about the genocide. Hopefully with Sandwich Bar. And I think that I hope that it will be. You know, really powerful, really. And then it's because it's suffused with a sense of where we are now. Even if I'm just talking about some other subject, it's kind of there in the background, really. And because you can't be a lecturer, can you? I think
you can't. You can't be a lecturer at all. I mean, what I find interesting, what I think we've in the West, I suppose. Kind of lost, perhaps, or maybe we never had it, is the world in which activism, agitation, and entertainment all coexist. I guess I'm referring to one person. I'm referring to Dario Fo, who was a very entertaining performer, very, you know, legendary and celebrated writer. And he was known as an anarchist. He was known as an anarchist activist who would turn up in the factories, in the striking factories, and perform for the workers as part of the strike, as part of the action. And it's more of a question that I'm posing now. It's like, is there now, in light of all this, is there something, is there some form or some space where all three can coexist, you know?
Right, I'm not fucking playing no factories.
Yeah, are you sure?
What's my dressing room? Where can I get? Where can I land my helicopter?
But it's an interesting question, you know. Like, can it coexist? You know, is the fact that we believe, and I agree with you, Alexei. It's like, you know, we have to be entertaining. Is the fact that we associate being entertaining with not necessarily being
challenging, really. You're making people think,
Or being an actual activist in the sense of being an activist, is the fact that is that itself, that association is a construct, right? That association of being, no, look, I'm just here to get laughs. You know, I'm, you know, the sort of, yeah, you know, Jimmy Carr, you know, he at one point said he was like, I don't do politics. I don't do political comedy. Yeah. I hope I'm not misquoting him, but
McIntyre said, didn't he, if you know, I won't do politics because I'll lose half my audience, you know, because they'll.
But the irony of someone like Jimmy Carr doing that, saying that, is like, well, a lot of what he does is very political, you know, like when he makes jokes about sponsoring African children or you know, he's made pretty off color jokes as well, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, that's intrinsically political, you know. And this idea that, you know, oh, no, no, I'm, it's, you know, there's a risk of that that association and that idea slipping into just co-opting whatever the mainstream is. So basically going, oh, sorry, BBC, what did you want me to? I can't. Yeah, I don't do anything political. Don't worry, I won't say that. That act in itself is political.
Yes, absolutely. That's what they want, isn't it?
We could do with better entertainment at the Palestine marches. But at the last one on the 18th of January, there was a full on band playing in Whitehall. Did either of you see that?
No,
I saw some Debka dancing and
which is fun. There's always like three dudes with like extremely loud, extremely crackly speakers, which kind of ruin the vibe. I fucking get so angry with them. But there was like a band set up, and there was keyboards, drums, bass, a singer, and they were singing these like Palestinian anthems, freedom anthems, and stuff.
Wow, I didn't see that.
They just needed a better tech guy because the balance wasn't. You had to stand in the exact right part of the circle to get the right balance, and it was like so close. But that is the best I've seen.
That's always that's always the things that we have to change. The fucking Zionists always have better PA. Never. There's a brilliant photograph. I would always like to find a copy of it. It's of the left-wing MP, Clive Lewis, relatively left-wing, and he's making a speech somewhere, and he's got one of these little kind of red and yellow megaphones that looks like a toy. Yeah, and what he's doing, because he's obviously not getting through to anybody, he's holding another little yellow in front of the first one. It's a brilliant, it sums the fucking stupidity of the left and technology brilliantly. He's holding these two, like, if I held another shitty megaphone in front of shitty megaphone I'm using, you know, I must try and find where that photo is. If anybody can source it for me, I would be very grateful because it's emblematic. But yeah, I'll make a note of that for my book. Where are you at? Do you think it's being who you are and doing what you do? Do you think it's helped? Do you think it's hindered? Where has it left you?
Interesting question. Has it helped? It's very hard to
measure. It's
something that's very difficult to measure, I think.
Yeah.
I think we will. I mean, the question I ask myself isn't really like, well, I do ask myself if I'm helping, but it's also, you know, in 30, 40 years time, if I'm still around, you know, will I look back and regret what I did or didn't do, you know? And
yeah,
I don't know until I reach that stage, but I would hope that the answer is no, I didn't regret what I did, you know,
Think that does, I mean, I would argue very strongly for doing the right thing, even if it cost you in many ways. Just, I mean, this is going out to the audience in a sense that it has been my observation that if you do the wrong thing, it can, if you're an even halfway decent person, it can corrode you in one way or another, really. It can eat at your soul.
Stormzy.
That's what I was thinking of, Stormzy.
Where am I at? I'm glad to be making the work I'm making. I'm very grateful to have the physical health, the mental, you know, wherewithal, and the resources at my disposal to be able to make stuff, because, you know, a lot of people don't have that, and I'm very grateful to be able to do that, and I'm very happy to be able to do it for a reason that is important to me. And that's probably where I'm at right now with it, I think.
Do you get those panel show offers? Are you in that league yet? Or do you think they would never?
I don't know how I'd perform on a panel show. I think I'd be quite confused as to what's going on around me. I would spend too long just staring at Jimmy Carr's round moon like face.
What's that? what's she called? Rachel Riley.
Oh yeah, her as well. Yeah, yes. I'd probably have a mental breakdown if I went on a panel show. No, yeah. I mean, it's interesting.
It's difficult. In fact, I was going to go on a panel show, and then I found that one of the guests was somebody I would disagree with, and I pulled out because I couldn't either sit quietly grinning at them, or I couldn't, you know, just I would either have to attack them or
yeah,
sit there grinning, really. And so that was, I thought, I don't regret that decision. It was traumatic at the time, really, because I actually had to pull out the night before the show was due to record.
Really?
Yeah. And it was one of the big ones. And
are you at liberty to say who the guest was?
No, I think. But it was one of those.
I get it.
Anti-Corbyn, you know.
Right, yeah.
Zionist. I mean, actually not Jewish, but... you know, I feel after the initial kind of sickening feeling of kind of confusion, I am pleased that I took that route, really, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting how decisions stay with us and then how we look at them in retrospect, isn't it? Yeah, so that's good. Difference. That's great.
Yeah, what fucking difference does it make as well in the end, really?
Go on. What's interesting is something I've read, because you're asking about panel shows and like that, the whole world of what we still consider mainstream comedy, quote-unquote, success.
Mm.
And something I realized quite early on in the genocide, actually, it was really, that's what brought it into sharp relief, was how the British comedy institutions and sort of its apparatus I think when you live in Britain and you do comedy in Britain, I think it's very easy to feel like that world is it, and that's all there is. And if you want success, if you want to make a living out of it, you need to get on you need to get your sitcom commissioned, you need to get on BBC Radio 4, you need to get on a panel show, etc. And something that really gave me, really sort of drove me forward during the genocide was seeing comedians who had got their following online. They were not interested in TV. TV wasn't interested in them. And they were doing very well out of it, and they were speaking out. I mean, I'm talking about Sami Obaid here, really. Whatever you think of his comedy, the fact remains that he has garnered a mass online following. He goes to a place, sells it out, and then, you know, talks about Palestine.
I don't know who he is. So
he's an American. He's an American Palestinian or Palestinian American comedian who prior to the genocide, he's a very pun based comedian, and now he still does a lot of puns, but it's all very centered around Gaza, Palestine, America, right. Israel, all that kind of stuff. Very, very like on the nose. Like he really goes for it, you know. And I have a lot of respect for him for that. And, you know, I was like, this guy's just done it, you know, by himself. You know, it made me kind of look at these institutions that we speak about, you know, of which the panel shows are a part, and kind of, I think they're on their way out. Maybe I'll be proven wrong, but I think TV's dying, and I think the industry
self-evidently it's dying.
It gives me, you know, I don't want to take pleasure in the death of an industry, but it does give me hope. does give me hope.
Yeah. No. Well, it is. It is. I mean, obviously, there is also the potential for, you know, that the right and the, you know, and just stupidity is seized on the internet, you know, in a massive way. But nevertheless, I said this before, but people sometimes complain because, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, Facebook and, you know, X and, you know, they fuck with, you know, they censor people.
Big time. Yeah.
You know, people moan about that. But on the other hand, if you wanted, you could still get the word out to millions and millions of people. You can do that, you know. Yeah, you know, I think about when I was in left-wing politics in the 1970s, that you would have to either freaking print your paper on this thing called a Gestetner machine, which did like blurry copies of, it's like a fucking, it was like a sort of Italian pasta making machine, but for propaganda. You'd either have to do like that, or you would have to pay to have your newspaper, your terrible newspaper, typeset, you know, in lead, and then printed off at some printers in Walthamstow, and then you would take your papers and try and sell them outside the main railway station, and people would punch you in the face and sneer at you, and that you'd stand there, you know, read the worker paper, the government's supposed to be in my side. I mean, compared to that, fucking hell, the way to spread the word now is so much easier than standing at, or you'd have to stand outside some political meetings with every other fucking lefty on the blind side and their dreary bloody papers, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it is, there is a world of opportunity out there to at least get the word out. I know that there is a lot of, there's a massive amount of noise as well, but yeah. So do you think that's what you'll do? I mean, that's what you want to do.
I just want to make work. Like, really, yeah. I think it's very easy, especially, I think comics have this problem of, we have this problem of wanting to sort of plan out our careers sometimes and to go, if I get this gig and that gig, yeah, I can do that and that. And I've come to the realization it just doesn't work like that. You know, if you, like I say, if you want to make God laugh, you make plans, you know, and you just, it doesn't work like that. You kind of, I just really want to focus on the process of making good or the best work that I can.
Yeah, yeah.
Good or not is up to other people. But I just want to focus on that process, and I want to be able to do it in spaces that are appropriate and supportive. And that's really what I'm doing moving forward. And if something's good, then if the people like it, that's great. You know, if it's,
I mean,
not,
I always think, I mean, in terms of that, you shouldn't see, I mean, the experience of working with hostile audiences is not a bad one for a comedian to have. You shouldn't necessarily put yourself through it if you can get away from that shit. But it's a useful thing to have done, I think, really.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, sorry, by appropriate spaces, I meant a theatre that has, like, lights and sound.
Yeah,
sorry. I meant, like...
Oh, not the factory.
Yeah, no.
Not the factory.
No. I was just I was separate. Which is the factory?
Where the strikes are happening, going entertaining the
strike. Yeah. No, I actually, to speak to that point, Alexia, I really enjoy hostile audiences.
Really?
I take great pleasure in hostile audiences.
Really?
I've only really bombed. I've bombed, obviously. Yeah. You know, I'm not going to. But that. There's only really one bomb that I actually, that made me sort of go a bit red in the, I get red in my ears. I don't blush. My ears go hot and red. There's only really one, and that was a tech issue. And I ended up eating a cigarette by mistake on stage. It was complicated.
I hate hostile audiences, but I think that having had that, you know, it's an essential part of your armory that you should know how to deal with them and have dealt with them in the past, I think. Yeah.
Oh, I guess it depends what you mean by hostile, I think. If it's genuinely disruptive and not letting you perform your comedy or get a word in, then that's a waste of time for everyone.
It is a waste of time, but it doesn't do you any harm to have been through that. You know, and sometimes to have won or even to have, you know, it doesn't do you any harm to have been through that once or twice, I think.
I hope people don't listen to me saying that and now intentionally.
Yeah, that's the worst.
That's it. Well, it's on record now, this podcast going out, so it's there.
When people come in with the intention of disrupting, it's the worst. Like, but when they're bristled and they say something or something strange happens or they disagree with something, you said, that can be used really well.
Yeah.
And you hinted at something earlier, Sammy, and I just want to, any of the best advice to any comedian out there dealing with hostile audiences or just struggling with their material? You said it earlier and I completely wanted to jump on it. It's just taking your time is so useful. It's the most useful tool on stage, is taking a breath, taking your time, slowing down, and it gives you time to think and deliver your stuff much better and engage with people. It's really cool. Is it worth now in the last bit of our show to talk to Sammy about what's happening? It actually, instead of comedy, let's talk about Gaza and Palestine and Trump and all that shit. What do you think, Alexi? Is that a worthwhile convo?
Sure, why not? Yeah.
Do you have, you know, the latest developments. This, you know, new this. I think it's. I can't decide whether it's laughable or whether to take him seriously with Trump talking about Gaza recently.
So I don't know that I've got anything interesting to say about any of that. Really, with you, Sammy?
God knows. I think. I mean, it's the way this new right wing have sort of won is by flooding the media, by playing the media and flooding it with garbage. And that garbage originates from words out of politicians' mouths. It's not just manipulated false news. And I think I found a great piece in... This sounds very wanky, but it's like one of the greatest forms of resistance is having inner peace and then being able to center yourself and then intentionally and consistently choose a piece of action or choose a way of life that resists.
Yeah.
Because what they're doing now is they're going, look at this bird, look at that one there, look over here, look over here, look over here now, look over here. And the minute you start playing that game, they've won.
Yeah.
And so the thing they fear the most is, you know, our own internal sumud, what Palestinians call sumud or steadfastness internally. I think that's what scares them, these insane right wingers. And so, yeah, that's where I am. And the more we can extract ourselves from every system possible, you know, whether you want to call it capitalism, neoliberalism, the nation state, the two-party system, you name it, the more we can sort of extract our reliance on that whole constellation of systems, I think the better for the future of us and our children, frankly.
Yeah. Which is absurd, really, but I feel much better because the killing stopped. And I know it hasn't completely stopped. And, you know, obviously people in Gaza are living in, you know, terrible conditions. But having to wake up every morning to those, to know that those artillery barrages and those rocket strikes are going on, just to not wake up to that every morning. And this I'm not saying this is a sensible or rational or decent position, but I just feel... just the awareness of that as being felt like a weight lifted off, and it, you know, it shouldn't in a way, but I can't help, you know, that's just our thought, really, just to, you know, that and you know what will come is probably an obscenity, and what is now is an obscenity, but just the fact that the killing has stopped. Then there is a big demonstration tomorrow, which they're expecting to be huge. I don't think I'll walk at the front this time. I don't know if I want to be. I want to confront the police again. But
we're saying all this, and this is being recorded Friday, 14th of February. And
yes,
Netanyahu is threatening to begin the bombardments again tomorrow, which is the day this will come out.
Isn't it now that Gaza has said that? I mean, the Hamas has said
Hamas have reeled back. Yeah, they've.
Yeah,
they want to comply, don't they? Or
yeah.
They want to prevent that from happening, but we don't know. So if this comes out and the bombs are dropping again, forgive us. We recorded this
before it came out.
Fingers crossed for tomorrow. But...
Yes, inshallah.
Inshallah.
All right. Anything else? We got to talk about
anything else on your list?
Anything else apart from
I'll come to you, Sammy, for any last thoughts. But I have to crowbar this in, and I'm fucking sick of talking about this stupid little Lego Alexi, which
you started it.
Yeah, I know, and it's wonderful, and it's our last one. Comes with a signed certificate of authenticity, and I have news about the auction. So we're auctioning this off because the winner of it refused to take it and said, "Let's auction it off and give the money to medical aid for Palestinians." Last week, it was a dismal like £15. The auction, it's at £180 now.
Woo! Come on.
Woo! That's right. Give it up on Instagram. Someone on Instagram called, edit this pause out. Tim on Instagram bid £180 for this little limited edition. It's our last one. Alexi sale Lego. We'll keep the bidding open for one more week. So you got another week to up that if you can. Let's see. Please support the show. If you can support the show, keep it going.
Yeah.
It any your little contributions, they all add up and it's incredible. At our Patreon, patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast. You can watch the video edition of this podcast on the Patreon and only on the Patreon, and any other extra bits we do. We might have some, fingers crossed, some exciting live shows happening this year. That will all go on the Patreon.
Yeah.
If you want to support the show, help pay my rent, go to patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast. And Sammy has a show coming. I'm glad you've got the dates. We weren't sure if you were going to know your dates in time for this recording, but what, 26th, 27th and the 31st of May at the Teatro Technis as part of the Shabak Festival, which is a great Middle Eastern festival, mainly folks around the South Bank, or is it all over London?
Teatro Technis in Camden Town.
Oh, well, that's in Camden.
Yeah. I think Shabak might have venues else doing things elsewhere. I'm not sure, though.
Well, that's exciting. Is there any other thoughts or anything you want to share, Sammy? And we'll have you back maybe in May to promote the show better.
Oh, that
as
would
well.
Be wonderful. Thank you. Yeah. No, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you really so much, guys.
Really
no,
nice chat.
Thank
I
you.
Appreciate
it's,
your time.
It's interesting to talk. And it's quite granular detail in a sense about comedy, but you know, I think that's what we're here for. I should also point out that I will be interviewing Ash Sarkar in Bath on Saturday after next, and then in Birmingham on the Sunday. If anybody knows what's going on with the fucking trains up to Birmingham, I'd be grateful they could let me know. So that's interesting. I'll be really interested. So obviously somebody from Novara Media and kind of one of the new left journalists, Lexi, talking to the kids, finding out what the kids are thinking about.
It
will be the only other time I've interviewed anybody is live, which was late last year when I did Miriam Margolyes. I'm assuming that said that Ash Sarkar won't ask me if I'm circumcised or recount tales of having random sex with men who ask her for directions in cars.
You're doing the Bath and Birmingham ones, are you?
Yeah.
That's Saturday the 22nd and Sunday the 23rd. Bath Comedia, Birmingham Glee Club, respectively. Yeah. Ash Sarkar in conversation is what you want to Google to get tickets for that.
Yeah.
I've got nothing to plug because I'm a loser, baby. Sammy came saw my improv team that I tried to plug the other week, Alexi, to much disdain. What did you think of our improv show, Sammy?
It was loads of fun, man. I highly recommend people go and see it.
It's the first ever Middle Eastern improv team in the UK.
I highly recommend people go and see it, just not me.
We called the Bazaar.
I didn't say that bit out loud for a reason. No.
We called the Bazaar. Bazaar Show on Instagram.
No, it was great fun.
Owned
it was
by
really
Mark
fun.
Kuckerberg.
And it's not like, I've not seen anything like it before. So it was great.
And like I was saying earlier, silly and zany. It's not, we're not up there doing like dark.
They're basically teaching us about the complexities of Middle Eastern politics in a lecture format.
through the form of poo jokes.
It's a 3-hour lecture, I would say. It's improv. It's stupid improv. It's great.
Love you, Sammy. Thank you, cool. Habibi, so
thank
much
you.
For coming. Bravo alaik and mabruk, and I'm so fucking proud and impressed of you, and glad I know you, bro.
Habibi,
thanks for coming.
Thank
on.
You.
Thank you.
Alexi, lovely to see you, Alexi.
And you.
Take care.
Bye bye. Bye bye, everybody. Bye bye.
You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkuti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.